Thank you. Thankful for your interest in this session. It always makes me sad that health system strengthening is not sort of more exciting of a topic, as you can see by our small audience, small in number, but hopefully loud in voice. And maybe we need to brainstorm about how to make this topic more sexy, because there really is not anything more important than health system strengthening. And it's something that at Partners in Health, I think we have a somewhat unique perspective on, because we are direct service providers and we work side by side with ministries of health to actually deliver care. And I think that really informed our Ebola response. And so we wanted to just share a few thoughts with you about how we looked at Ebola and the crisis and how it relates to health system strengthening. I think it's probably been said 1,000 times in the last 2 days of this conference that there have been more than 17,000 cases of Ebola, 12,000 confirmed, 6,491 deaths. And there was a real significant drop in case fatality rate from early to late in the epidemic, probably due to earlier case detection, less delay in therapy, and more treatment beds. This is all updated as of this weekend. So there were some really positive stories, and in fact, I think the global health and public health communities came together as never before to really try to stem the tide of what was predicted to be even a much more significant epidemic. So I think there's a lot to be proud of. And yet, I think there's a lot we can learn. When Partners in Health launched into supporting the epidemic, it was in September of 2014. We are a small organization, a non-governmental organization based in Boston. Our largest project is in Haiti, where we've been for 30 years and made a long-term commitment to the people of Haiti and to the government of Haiti to revitalize the public sector, and we operate alongside the government 12 facilities there, from primary care clinics to secondary care hospitals and even a tertiary care teaching hospital. In that work, we often think you have to really link treatment and prevention. I think we made our voices very well known in the AIDS, beginning of the AIDS epidemic, on how to link prevention and treatment, but not only that, also how to link the delivery of HIV services with the provision of basic health services. And so we were asked, and since in the last 15 years, we've spread to Africa, most notably Rwanda, Lesotho, Malawi. And in Rwanda, I think our partnership with the government has really borne the most fruit, very good governance on the health side, and the use of a collaborative process to develop a very good model for healthcare delivery that goes all the way from the community to secondary hospitals. I think in Ebola, one of the things that frightened us was the first attempts at Ebola were largely focused on prevention, and there was really insufficient treatment. And we know that the wonderful organization MSF was kind of holding up the world in this capacity and providing most of the Ebola treatment, but there were just simply not enough beds. And I think when you think about trying to teach people about Ebola when they cannot come forward because there weren't enough beds, it was a very frightening proposition. This was a common poster that one would see in Sierra Leone or Liberia, which would say, "Do always wash your hands with soap and water." And of course, many people had no access to either soap or water. "Do always cook your food properly," which, again, I don't think really had very much at all to do with the epidemic. We think that probably the very first case of Ebola was a zoonotic transmission from an animal or animal feces or animal blood to a human, but that every other case was human to human. So I think a lot of these prevention messages, and on the other side about bushmeat and not playing with monkeys, I think that the prevention was really not geared toward the proper issue, which was the human-to-human spread, and to try to enable prevention by providing the right tools, whether it's water, buckets, which happened later, and I think we saw a lot of success later. But also, it was hard for people to come forward for care, and it would say, you know, tell anyone you meet about Ebola, that Ebola is real, and call for help, you know, if you have questions, and encouraging people to go to the health facility. The biggest box there is to go to the health facility. But I can tell you from my long experience in the field of global health, some of these most of the health facilities in Sierra Leone and Liberia are among the worst health facilities we've ever seen. There are insufficient staff. The staff was totally unprotected. And in some cases, a person being told to go to a health facility meant that person would inevitably die, and the infection would spread to health workers. And in the case of Phoebe Hospital in Liberia, one case, a new case of Ebola, came into that hospital and infected 7 health workers, all of whom died. So I think the rush to prevention without thinking of the systems piece, the rush to prevention without trying to enable people to have the tools they need, was something that we could do better about in the future. And this is just some of the pictures that were shown, you know, the bushmeat eating, as if there were 17,000 cases of bushmeat transmission. There was not. And in fact, it's very important that people to continue to eat protein so we don't have the knock-on effects of childhood malnutrition, you know, worsening protein calorie malnutrition. And many of the markets that people, you know, these areas are rainforests. Many people are hunters. They sell meat as their livelihoods. So their livelihoods and the nutritional content of the food would go down if people weren't to eat bushmeat. But there was no reason to not eat bushmeat. So there are certain things, you know, and then similarly, a lot was talked about with the funeral, and yes, you can educate people about last rites, but pretty much in every culture, there is last rites of washing the body, and it was kind of exoticized as if it was something specifically African or specifically Sierra Leonean or Liberian, and in fact, it was just how do we do this safely, and there were a lot of, I think, successes in safe burials, but I think a lot of the prevention messages served to kind of exoticize a disease that was just simply human-to-human transmission in a very aggressive fashion. For us at Partners in Health, we said the only exotic animal we really were concerned about was the canary in the coal mine of health systems. And that's what we said about Ebola, that Ebola is actually a canary in the coal mine of a very, very weak health system. Not enough staff, not enough stuff, supplies, materials, gloves, hand washing, not enough space to do proper triage, and not enough systems of surveillance. These key elements, the staff, stuff, system, space, are going to be key whatever is the epidemic, whether it's tuberculosis, a very slow-moving epidemic, or a very rapid one like Ebola. You cannot really help to treat and prevent without those health systems. And in these post-conflict countries, like in West Africa, the current conflict countries like in southern Sudan and Afghanistan, we see that the health indicators are just horribly proportionate to the degree of conflict, the degree of loss of the health workforce. So again, Ebola spread was really one zoonotic offense, thousands of transmissions person to person, and health workers themselves suffered very high casualties. I just want to also remind you of the baseline data of these countries are some of the worst in the world prior to Ebola. So the maternal mortality ratio in Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone was in each of the countries nearly 900 to 1,000 deaths per 100,000, among the highest in the world. And similarly, child mortality. And I could say a legion about child mortality reduction, but I will refrain. I always find these Google Mappers or the Gapminder images very interesting. This is public health, government health expenditure per capita, and you can see the usual lump that would be West Africa completely disappears in this map, showing that these are some of the most underfunded kind of moribund systems. And so if we look at that as any kind of indicator of the robustness of the ability to withstand an epidemic, we just don't see that in West Africa. So we had 5 pillars of our response that we really linked not only to preventing and treating Ebola, but to staying for the long haul and to try to help the governments to revitalize and rebuild the health systems, not to where they were before, but to much better. So the first was to stop transmission. I'll mention that briefly. To treat Ebola, of course, because more treatment beds we believed would bring people forward sooner and would lower the mortality rate. To strengthen the health system for everything else. Many of the people who came over and over again with fever during Ebola triage actually had tuberculosis and other infectious diseases like HIV. And simultaneously, really, to work to have a long-term plan to train the health workforce. These are some of the countries with the lowest physician and nurse ratios per capita on Earth, and this will not help withstand future epidemics. And then, how do we use this to generate new knowledge to learn from the future? So, our comprehensive strategy for Ebola was a health system strengthening strategy that we do everywhere, which is hire a lot of community health workers that can go and talk about Ebola, but can also do active case finding for malnutrition, for HIV, for tuberculosis, not just Ebola-only workers, but polyvalent community health workers, if you will, who can really shepherd people to care. The second was linking safe Ebola management, early Ebola management, and triage to primary health care. The primary health centers in these countries have no medicines. We started to support one primary health center in Liberia, for example, 60,000 people. There was one medicine in the store, and that was in the depot of that health center, and it was ORS, which is arguably not even a medicine. And then lastly, how do we do district-level care that will link Ebola treatment but also provide the other care that is so desperately needed, particularly things like cesarean section in countries where you know that the maternal mortality is very, very high and you need some more sophisticated strategies, particularly on emergency medical care. So we were very blessed to work with two excellent grassroots organizations, one Well Body Alliance in Sierra Leone and the other Last Mile Health in Liberia, and worked with them to really ramp up the hiring and training of community health workers. This is a Well Body Alliance employee named Fanta. She's a community health worker who's been working in this community for 10 years and doing HIV, doing tuberculosis, and then also can be a trusted person to talk about Ebola. It's not like bringing in a whole new cadre of scary outside people who are going to tell you about Ebola. And so she was able to really provide assistance to families and even help to do quarantine in a way that was very humane, and I'll talk more about that in a second. We also employed as many survivors as we could find, with a couple of reasons. Our work as activists on the HIV side show that people living with the experience of having disease are powerful advocates and really can help people come forward. The fact that they've survived at all was a very positive thing. They have some level of immunity. Of course, we didn't count on that, and they were protected if need be. But also, we wanted a job creation strategy. Many of these Ebola survivors were extremely impoverished because of the disease. So they were already poor people who then had their houses burned down, were run out of town, lost their jobs. And so we really wanted to develop a network of survivors that could be part of our workforce. This is one of them, who he now, and dozens, hundreds of other survivors. And of course, now that we're seeing the long-term effects of Ebola, we also have these survivors in care. They're registered, they have eye exams, they can have neurologic exams. So that's a very helpful way to, just like with HIV, bring people into care and have them be activists. And then it's very important to us that we support the government. This, for us, it turned out was more controversial than we anticipated. To treat Ebola requires a fairly sophisticated level of infrastructure. And I'm a great admirer of the work that many of the real Ebola organizations did. The infrastructure of the Ebola treatment unit has very clear lines, green zone, red zone. However, when we entered, particularly in Sierra Leone, there was a massive surge going on in the western area of the country, and there were no NGOs that were willing to dive into the public sector and help. They were willing to support the public sector, but wanted to build a proper ETU, and we said, okay, we're not going to do that. We're going to go to public facilities and try to retrofit them as best we can so that we could support the government and support the Sierra Leonean colleagues who were already providing care. And so we operated one very, very large Ebola treatment unit in Mafourke in Sierra Leone. All of the staff were Ministry of Health employees with a handful of partners and health employees as well. We had two high-profile nosocomial infections of our staff, one American, one Sierra Leone, both, thank God, survived. It was not pretty, but we did treat 3,600 patients and before any of the other treatment facilities were open in that region. And then I think most importantly, and I'll wrap up for out of respect for time, we felt that all of this had to be done with the rebuilding of the health system. The hospitals, the health centers really are insufficient for human health. And we can't just sort of say let's go back to where we were. These countries have very, very high mortality, morbidity. And as the health system collapsed, we recognized that more people were dying of non-Ebola causes than Ebola. And as we started to see the Ebola cases tail down, pretty much everyone with fever who came in, as I mentioned, had other diseases. These are countries that have had increasing TB rates. TB prevalence and incidence has increased in both Sierra Leone and Liberia over the last 5 years, and this is for lack of a health system. So I think we felt that it was very important and have tried to now renovate 2 district hospitals, work with staff, and about 5 health centers in Sierra Leone, and in Liberia, a district hospital and 2 health centers. So we're really trying to do that. What's interesting to me is that, at least in the case of Liberia, Liberia was reported to being near to meeting their Millennium Development Goal for child health. And I think it's just something for us all to reflect on. And what I think I've recognized over this period of seeing these health systems, which were really destroyed, and not by Ebola, pre-Ebola, by the war, by the underfunding, by structural adjustment, by many of the other sort of slights on the health system. And I think you can meet the Millennium Development Goal for children without building much of a health system. You can do it a lot out of backpacks. You can deliver a lot of vaccinations, a lot of vitamin A. You can do deworming. It's all good. But it's not really going to meet our goals for maternal mortality reduction. It's not going to help us to eliminate TB, no less control it. And so I think we really have to think seriously about if that's a yardstick that we feel is meaningful in and of itself. I think it's great, and I'm happy that more children are surviving as a pediatrician, but I think we have to do much better than that. And then lastly, we're working in both countries to look at a long-term workforce planning issue with the Clinton Health Access Initiative. We're doing human resource mapping in both Liberia and Sierra Leone. In Liberia, it's pretty far along, and we're hoping that we will be having large training programs like we do in Rwanda for doctors, nurses, health managers, and even for community health workers on a national scale, because these countries really simply do not have enough health workers to deliver health care properly, and there's no way we're going to be able to combat Ebola and prevent it from coming back, and all of the long-term complications of epidemic diseases if we don't rebuild the workforce. So I'll end there and just say we're very proud of the fact that we were able to do some significant science during this period and published a study on a rapid diagnostic even in the throes of the worst period of the Ebola epidemic. So I think if you build the proper platform and train enough local professionals, you can really learn a lot in the process as well, and we're very proud of that work. So just on behalf of our amazing transnational team, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joya. Dr. Mukherjee has to go to a different panel, so we thank you again for being here this afternoon. I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative and ask if there are any questions for Joya. We can take one or maybe two, and then we'll transition to the second panelist. Any questions?
Yeah.
Please.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I have a question about community health workers.
Yeah.
The role of the Ebola response. It's obviously the power that these have, the impact they can have, right? The question about the sustainable funding model you used, one of the points was that you had to compensate these people.
Yeah.
And what sort of models or strategies you have in place to ensure that they were compensated in a sustainable way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, because that tends to be the bottom line, and I think there's no sustainable model on the current existing health budget of this country. These countries are totally bankrupt on the health side, and that is why the health system looks the way it does. So we have to really think about broadening the pie, as we did for HIV. We can't say, okay, let's put it back on the countries to afford this. So what we've basically said is we'll fund it public money, and at the same time, we will try to help the government itself to leverage money from the donor community to improve the workforce, to make a long-term commitment. Hopefully, the government will put in a higher share of GDP, but frankly, even if government, every government in Africa met their Abuja promise of putting in 15% of their GDP, it would still not be enough to meet all of the MDGs without voter support. So I think, I personally think we have to think of the sustainability question as how do we sustain external support for these governments for the next 20 years so that we really change the playing field. These countries will revert instantaneously to where they were, and where they were was a setup for this terrible epidemic. And so it's really, I think it's on us as an international community to think of a new way of looking at sustainability that doesn't just depend on the government's public sector.
Thank you. Any other questions for our first panelist? Okay, great. Thank you again, Joya. Let's give her one more round of applause.